Lecture 27, What Mummies Tell Us.
Welcome back. I'm glad the mummies didn't scare you away. We're going to do some more mummy business today. What I'd like to do is show you that the mummies themselves are perhaps the best way to figure out the process of mummification. Last time we saw there were a few papyri that talked about mummification, but not really how to do it. They told us about wrapping, about the incense, about some of the rituals, and that the body had to be placed in the tomb after 70 days. But they really didn't give you the how-to. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about that today. And as I say, the best place to start is with mummies. Now, first, not all mummies are the same. You know, we tend to think of a mummy as a mummy as a mummy. But remember, the Egyptians were mummifying for 3,000 years. Certainly the process was going to change. They were going to get better at it, and maybe even worse at it sometimes. Just like cars, not all cars are the same. The Model T is different from, you know, a modern car. So they changed, and they got it better and maybe went worse for a while, but not all mummies are the same. Let's talk about mummies of the Old Kingdom. Now, remember, the Old Kingdom is the era of pyramid building. It's the era of Sneferu and Khufu. If you look at an Old Kingdom mummy, you get the feeling that they weren't really intending to preserve the body. They were really trying to make a statue almost. If you look at Old Kingdom mummies of fairly wealthy people, very often what you've got is a layer of bandages that have been coated with plaster, and the features of the deceased are painted on the plaster or sometimes carved into it. And what you're really making almost is a statue of the deceased with his body inside, but there isn't a great deal of preservation of the body going on. It's kind of, I think, almost in case the body is destroyed, you still got the plaster coating, so the ka, the soul, will know where to go. So really, Old Kingdom bodies are not in very good shape. They weren't really dehydrating as we know it, removing the brain, none of that. It's more cosmetics, an outer shell that looks pretty good. By the way, you know, the Egyptians aren't the only ones who mummified. And in Asia, there are some mummies that are quite similar to Old Kingdom mummies, meaning they're kind of good on the outside, but not so good on the inside. There are some Vietnamese mummies of priests of the 16th century who were basically lacquered. They died, they were placed in a seated posture, and then lacquer was sort of painted over the bodies and then gilded. So you've got them in temple shrines looking very much like statues. And they've been x-rayed, and inside you can see, inside the thing is just collapsed. The bones are all at the bottom. There's no skin holding it together. There's no tissue. And that's very much like the Old Kingdom mummies. They're kind of statues, but no real attempt at preserving well. The earliest sort of good attempt at a mummy, an Old Kingdom mummy, there is a couple of Old Kingdom mummies that are pretty good, is Queen Hetepheris. Now, Queen Hetepheris is an important woman in the Old Kingdom. She is the mother of my man Sneferu. Remember Sneferu, the one who showed Egypt how to build the pyramid? She's the wife of Sneferu, the mother of Khufu, the builder of the Great Pyramid. She's the wife of a king, King Sneferu, and the mother of Khufu, real pyramid-building family. Her mummy is a great mystery story. I'll give you the facts, and you figure out what happened. The tomb of Queen Hetepheris was discovered during this century by an American excavator from Boston, Reisner, great Egyptologist. It was found right next to the Great Pyramid at Giza, right next to her son's pyramid. It was found beneath a paving stone. There's a paving stones around the Great Pyramid. And the excavators found a sealed shaft leading down to a small burial chamber. There was no question about it. This tomb was untouched for 4,500 years. An intact burial. Pretty impressive. Everybody was really thrilled. And they were going to do the opening of the burial chamber, and they had important officials present, of course, because This was an important tomb. Now, the first thing they found was a canopic chest. Now, let me explain about a canopic chest, what that means. As you now know from our man Herodotus, certainly, at the time of mummification, the internal organs were removed. These internal organs were eventually going to be placed in what we call canopic jars. Four jars. And the jars are hollowed out, made of stone usually. And the lids of the jars are sometimes carved with heads of four human heads. And sometimes they're carved with animal heads, three animal heads, one human. Sometimes it's the head of a human. Sometimes it's the head of a jackal. Sometimes it's the head of an ape, and sometimes it's the head of a falcon. These are the four sons of Horus. Horus, the falcon god, who avenges his father's death. The four sons of Horus are the guardians of the internal organs. They are supposed to guard the internal organs. So sometimes, if you're a wealthy person, you had canopic jars, and you had your little internal organs placed in them. Queen Hetepheris had a canopic chest. It was made out of alabaster. Big piece of alabaster, you know, about the size of maybe a nightstand. And it was carved out into four sections. And in each of the four sections were Queen Hetepheris' internal organs. They had been put in a solution of natron. That, remember that powder that's used to dehydrate the body? Natron is basically, I'll give you the chemistry and then I'll tell you what it really is. It's sodium carbonate, sodium bicarbonate, and sodium chloride. It's basically baking powder and table salt. That's basically what it is. Well, there was a solution of that, and her internal organs were placed in it. So, fine. We have Queen Hetepheris' canopic chest, her internal organs, and we know that she is our first mummy for sure who was eviscerated, who had the organs taken out during the pyramid period. Fine so far. Next, her sarcophagus is in the tomb. Now, as I said, various dignitaries were present for the opening of this sarcophagus because this was a big deal. The tomb didn't have just the canopic chest and the sarcophagus. It had her furniture, beautiful, elegant furniture. She had jewelry. And remember, Sneferu, her husband, sent expeditions to the turquoise mines in the Sinai? She had beautiful bracelets with inlaid butterflies made out of turquoise. Nice stuff. I mean, elegant, elegant. And then there was her sarcophagus. Well, various officials were lowered into the shaft, into the burial chamber. They had like a kind of a desk chair, a big chair, and they had a pulley system where they would crank the visitor down in the chair. They'd tie him in the chair, put him down. So they have a pretty crowded tomb, and it's kind of difficult to get around, to move. But they're going to remove the lid of the sarcophagus so all the officials can be present at this great moment. Reisner, the excavator, is supervising. His artist was there, Joseph Lyndon Smith, great artist, archaeological artist, who was recording what was going on. And they remove the lid, right, sliding it slowly off, right? And Joseph Lyndon Smith is the first one to look in. There's no Queen Hetepheris. This is a sealed tomb. Nobody's been in it in 4,500 years. The internal organs of the queen are there. The furniture of the queen is there. Her bracelets are there. But the queen isn't there. Joseph Lyndon Smith looks inside. Now, George Reisner, the excavator, is a little bit off to the side, looks in and he says, George, it's a dud. The prime minister of Egypt says, what's a dud? Right? This kind of colloquial term. And then Reisner sees that there's no queen in the sarcophagus. And he says to everybody assembled, he said, gentlemen, Queen Hetepheris is not receiving today, but Mrs. Reisner has cookies up top. And that's what happened. The queen's body was missing. Now, what's going on here? Why is the queen's body missing when you have her internal organs? I will give you a theory. It is Reisner's theory, the excavator. And I will preface it by saying, Reisner read a lot of murder mysteries. That's what he loved to do. He loved, in his spare time, to read murder mysteries. And I think the murder mysteries have influenced his suggestions to what happened. And by the way, Reisner gave his library, when he died, he willed all his books to the Widener Library at Harvard, and you can still get Reisner's murder mysteries. They're still there. And he annotates and says, good, pretty good, bad, you know. But anyway, Reisner suggests the following as a scenario. Queen Hetepheris, the mother of Khufu, wife of Sneferu, is buried first at Dahshur, where her husband had his pyramids. Remember, Sneferu built several pyramids, right? First the Meidum pyramid collapsed. Then he tried the Bent pyramid, and that had difficulties. And finally he was buried in the Red Pyramid of Dahshur. Well, his wife probably was buried close to the husband, is what Reisner suggests. But after a while, perhaps her son is now ruling, Khufu, building his pyramid. Her tomb was robbed. Robbers got into her tomb at Dahshur. And perhaps, just perhaps, they destroyed the body. They were looking for jewelry. Often the bodies are destroyed because in the bandages are often magical amulets of gold, because gold is the metal of eternity. They destroyed the body, but the internal organs remained, and other things remained, like the furniture. Now, the guards of the tomb are afraid to tell Khufu, your mother's body has been destroyed. I mean, she's lost her chance at immortality. They're afraid to tell the king, your mother's dead, gone for eternity, not just now. So what they do is they reseal the sarcophagus, and they tell Khufu, your mother's body, they broke into the tomb, but everything's okay. The sarcophagus was untouched. The internal organs are there. Everything's fine. So they're afraid to tell the king that the body's missing. So now Khufu decides, well, Dahshur isn't a safe place. I'm going to move my mother's body to where I'm being buried. I'm going to put her next to my pyramid beneath the paving. So the body is moved, and the king feels his mother's body is intact. Everything's fine. So it's buried just as if it was complete, and that may have been what happened. That was Reisner's suggestion as to what happened. It makes a nice kind of mystery story even, and it's possible. It's possible. But the important thing for us is that Queen Hetepheris's body at least shows us during the Old Kingdom, a queen was eviscerated. The internal organs were taken out. So in the Old Kingdom, they knew, if you really want to preserve a body, take out the internal organs. Now, as I said, there are all kinds of mummies. Good mummies, bad mummies. They come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And what you got depended, as Herodotus told us, on what you could afford. So the bodies of commoners, especially, vary considerably. But there are certain sort of constants. As you know, the internal organs were taken out through a slit in the abdomen. Almost always, it's on the left side. A lot of people don't. Why the left side? Well, the answer is your body isn't perfectly symmetrical, you know. It's not. And the left side gives you better access to the descending colon. So I think it would be easier for the embalmers to get at it that way. So maybe that's why it's always on the left side. But almost all the mummies we see have been eviscerated on the left side. Also, in the better mummifications, we do see the brain removed through the nose, as Herodotus said. So he was right there. And sometimes, remember when we talked about with Tutankhamun's skull, resin is poured inside the skull to kind of cauterize it. Hot molten resin is poured in. So there are certain things you look for in mummies to get an idea, you know, of when was it? Was it a wealthy person? Was it this? Was it that? But you have to look at a lot of mummies. And one of the greatest finds for students of mummies, people who specialize in mummies, was a cache of mummies called the Deir al-Bahari mummy cache. Now this is royal mummies. And let me explain how this cache came about. Remember, Deir al-Bahari is a site on the west bank of Thebes where Mentuhotep built his temple, where Hatshepsut built her temple, they're next to each other. And the discovery of the Deir al-Bahari cache took a lot of detective work. In the late 1870s, fantastic royal jewelry began appearing on the Egyptian antiquities market. people were selling royal jewelry. Now, where did it come from? Even books of the dead, beautiful papyri for kings and queens, were being sold. People figured the tomb robbers, modern tomb robbers, had found a royal tomb. Somewhere in the Valley of the Kings, perhaps, they had found a royal tomb. The head of the Antiquity Service, who was a Frenchman, Mariette, came down trying to find out where the royal tomb was. Didn't find. He died before they ever found it. He died just in the period. But his successor, Gaston Maspero, another Frenchman, the French were running the Antiquity Service this time, wanted to find that royal tomb. Now, one of his students of Mariette, Wilbur, an American politician who sort of had to get out of town, and he left from Brooklyn, left Brooklyn, and he decided to devote his life to Egyptology, fell in love with Egyptology, became a scholar, could translate, spent most of his summers, you know, winters in Egypt, summers writing up his notes, translating inscriptions, a real scholar, also a collector. Much of the Brooklyn Museum's wonderful collection was donated by Wilbur, and the library were his books. Wilbur was in Egypt, and Maspero wanted to use him to try to figure out who's finding what. And he bought some pieces on the antiquities market that belonged to kings. And Wilbur said, you know, the Razul family, now they were a family of grave robbers, went back many generations of grave robbers. They lived in the town of Gurna, right near the Valley of the Kings. And Wilbur thought, you know, it's got to be the Razuls. And he said, one of the Razuls has a new white house. I bet it's built over the tomb. Right? It wasn't. Right? It wasn't. But indeed, the Razuls had found the tomb. The Razuls were questioned by the police. Now, when I say questioned, they were tortured. This was the 1870s. Now it's almost 1880. They were tortured. One of the Razul brothers limped for the rest of his life. But they didn't reveal where the tomb was. In 1880, I believe it was, the eldest of the Razul brothers went to the police and said, I will show you where the tomb is. Apparently the brothers had made a deal or something. We're not sure. But he said, I will show you. Now, the police, very sharp, they went straight to the Razul's house, figuring the Razuls would have made one last trip to the tomb, gotten some goodies to sell in the future, and they did indeed find some things in the house. They did. But the Razuls then took them to the tomb. Now, the tomb was more than anybody could have ever expected. The inspector who was sent down, his name is Brugesch. Brugesch was sent down to see this tomb. He was led up a mountain pass near the Valley of the Kings, not in the Valley of the Kings. It wasn't at all what anybody thought. He was led up a mountain path, Deir al-Bahari, near Hatshepsut's temple. And there was a pit going down, a shaft. And he was lowered down through the shaft, and then he went into a tomb, a passageway. But the passageway was almost clogged with coffins. Not one, not two, but dozens of coffins. And as he walked through, there were also on the floor little servant statues that had been buried with these people. And there were things like boxes for the women's wigs. It was not just the coffins, but it was also some of the goods that went with it. And as he went by, there was another room, and there were still more mummies and coffins. Now, he was a bit of a scholar. He wasn't a great scholar, Brugesch, but he could read the names on the coffins. And he couldn't understand what was happening. Because here were the mummies of the kings and queens of Egypt, of different dynasties. For example, now, you know some history by now, some of our Egyptian history. There was the mummy of Thutmose I, who had constructed the first tomb in the Valley of the Kings. There was the mummy of Thutmose III, the great warrior king. But there was also the mummy of Ramses the Great, who's from the next dynasty. There were also mummies of kings and queens of the 21st dynasty, still further into the future. How did these mummies, spanning such a period of time, all come together? Brugesch was really puzzled. The answer is that this convention of kings and queens came together because at one point in Egypt's history, and we'll get to that in detail, Egypt had slid again, wasn't the power it used to be, and the Valley of the Kings was no longer guarded. So there was a rash of tomb robbings of the royal tombs. And a later king, when he took inventory, a king of the 21st dynasty, when he took inventory in the Valley of the Kings, he saw all these august ancestors had been defiled. He gathered them all together, and he wanted to put them in a safe place, a secret place, a hidden place. So he had this tomb constructed secretly. And that's how the mummies of Thutmose I, Thutmose III, Ramses II, Seti I, Pinhagen, Queen Hennetawi, names we'll know, we'll be talking about in detail. That's how they all came together in this tomb. And they lay there undisturbed till the 1870s when the Razul brothers found it. I'll tell you how I think they found it. These people, the tomb robbers, are very sharp. It rains in Egypt rarely, especially in the south, very rarely, but there is an occasional downpour. And that's when you look for tombs. You look to see where the water is running off, where it's disappearing into the ground. And probably they waited for a downpour, and then they could see water disappearing. Another way you look, by the way, is at the ground. You look for stones that aren't like the stones of the area. You look for little fragments of pink granite. Pink granite doesn't come from Luxor, you know, from Deir al-Bahari. It comes from Aswan. So if you see little pieces of pink granite, you know, somebody brought a sarcophagus in, it's been chipped, but there's something nearby. So two ways, you look for water running off, or you look for different stones, right? So the Razuls, one way or the other, had found this cache of mummies. Now, Brugesch had the responsibility of removing these mummies. Now, it was a great responsibility, because the people of Gurna, that city, had made their living by robbing tombs forever. And they would kind of view this as their heritage. And this was the gold mine of all gold mines. This was worth a fortune to all of them. And in a sense, they were losing their heritage. So he had to move quickly. He was not able to take pictures, right? There were no diagrams drawn of where the mummies were. We don't know their exact placements. The earliest sort of description you get of this, really, is in the newspapers. Because the newspapers, the Illustrated London News, you know, had drawings of the mummies. And it gives us an idea of what it looks like. But this was an amazing find. You had this elegant mummy of Seti I looking just so beautiful. You had Ramses the Great. You had all the great kings and queens of Egypt. And they were moved very quickly, very quickly. He didn't want any robbery to go on. So a steamer, all these mummies were brought up, placed on a steamer, and they went to Cairo. They were going to be placed in the Egyptian Museum, which was then at Boulak, a suburb. Now, it's interesting that as the mummies steamed along the Nile, people knew what was on that steamer. And the women of the villages gathered along the banks of the Nile and wailed, just like a funeral, as they do today. And they wailed for their dead kings who were going by. It's rather eerie. Everybody who was there says it's rather eerie. But these mummies give us a really unique opportunity. Because you know what? For the first time, we can see all of these royal mummifications. But even more important, these mummies provided the embalmers of ancient Egypt a chance to see how good their predecessors had done. Think about it. The king of the 21st dynasty is gathering bodies of the 18th, 19th, and 20th dynasties. And they've been damaged, badly damaged. So he says to his embalmers, repair the bodies of the kings. Now, for the first time ever, embalmers can see what a mummy is looking like after 200 years of a king. So they get an idea, and they weren't happy. They really thought the mummification wasn't that good. So they did lots of new things. Let me tell you what we learn from these mummies. First of all, remember I said the brain is removed through the nose. Well, the first time the brain was ever removed seems to be the 18th dynasty. That's when it starts, the removal of the brain. So that's something we know. And by the end of this lecture, you'll be able to hopefully look at a mummy and you can figure out when it's from. If the brain is removed, you know it's after the 18th dynasty, right? If it looks like a statue rather than well-preserved body, you know it's Old Kingdom. There are many, many suggestions. One of the things that happened, though, is when they looked and they saw that there were all these robberies, all these problems, they decided, 21st dynasty, that rather than take out the internal organs and place them in canopic jars, because when the robbers came in, they knocked over the canopic jars, the organs were stepped on, destroyed, it wasn't safe enough. In the 21st dynasty, they started removing the organs, they would dehydrate them, and then put them back inside the body, inside that incision, so that, in a sense, the body would be intact. So that robbers, even if they did something, the internal organs would be inside. So now you don't need canopic jars anymore. But, you know, you still want those sons of Horus to protect you. So they did two things. In the 21st dynasty, they had little amulets in the shape of the sons of Horus. One is a little jackal, right, who is not Anubis. It's a different jackal called Duamatef. Another is in the shape of the ape. Another is the shape of the human. Another, you know, the shape of the falcon. And they put the little, each organ has a little amulet with it to protect it. But the other thing they did is they also made false canopic jars. They made jars that looked just like canopic jars, made out of limestone, head of a falcon, head of a this, head of a that. But the jars' lids don't come off. It's all one solid piece. It's a kind of false jar. But the idea is you'll have the sons of Horus to protect you. So for a while, they put the organs back into the mummy. One other thing they did, that I think was because when they looked at the mummies, they weren't pleased with what they saw. They looked at the mummy and it looked emaciated. It really didn't look like a person. I mean, it looked like a person, a recognizable person. If you knew Ramses the Great and you saw his mummy, you'd say, oh, there's Ramses' mummy. But it doesn't look like a living person. So the embalmers of the 21st dynasty started a new practice. They made incisions under the skin of their 21st dynasty kings. And they put a white material, like not fabric, I don't mean fabric, it's kind of a cheesy-like material, an organic substance, under the skin and pushed it all the way in, literally fleshing out the skin. See, after the body's dehydrated, it looks pretty skeletal and cadaverous. Well, they fleshed out the body. They made it look a little bit more lifelike. So that's a new development. If you find a mummy with incisions in the skin, often under the armpits, often they fleshed out the cheeks. You know it's after the 21st dynasty. So not every mummy's the same. So these bodies were all taken to the Egyptian Museum near Cairo. And some of them were quickly unwrapped. They didn't learn much. They didn't really know how to study mummies. They were unwrapped. I feel bad about that. They should have been left as they were. But there were many, many, many were unwrapped. But this wasn't the only royal mummy find. There was going to be one more. In 1898, the new head of the Antiquity Service, Victor Loret, Frenchman, found the tomb of Amenhotep II. But in the tomb was a side room, and in that side room were other royal mummies. It had been bricked up with stone. They were great mummies, I mean important mummies. And one of them, one we know very well now, the mummy of Amenhotep III, the grandfather of Tutankhamun and the father of Akhenaten, that mummy was there. The mummy with the bad teeth. Right? And that's because of that discovery, that's how I can tell you that he had bad teeth and maybe couldn't rule at the end of his reign. You know, one of the reasons the Egyptians had bad teeth was the bread. It was packed with sand. See, when you grind things on a grindstone, you always get a little bit of the grindstone in your bread. And in a desert country, more sand. So as the Egyptians were eating their bread, it was grinding down their teeth. Like sandpaper. So almost all Egyptians, commoners and kings, had bad teeth. Right? But this tomb of Amenhotep II gave us some more royal mummies. So not all mummies are the same. And the best way we have of figuring out the process of embalming so far has been to actually look at the mummies. But there's one more way you can figure out how they embalmed. And that's by actually doing a mummification. And that's what I did a few years back, and I'll tell you about that next time. That when I took a human cadaver and mummified it in the ancient Egyptian style. See you then.